Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with George Bishop, whose new novel is Night of the Comet. We'll also have a conversation with Baton Rouge Advocate columnist Danny Heitman about the problems of inheriting books. George Bishop is one of the bright lights of contemporary Louisiana fiction. His first novel, A Letter to My Daughter, was published in 2010, and now he's back with The Night of the Comet, which takes us back to 1973 when the comet Kohoutek blazed across the sky. Welcome to The Reading Life, George.
Thanks, Susan.
Now, you've got quite the resume for a writer. You grew up in small town Louisiana,
right.
Went to Loyola.
Right.
They went off to L.A. to become an actor.
Yes.
Starred in I Was a Teenage Vampire.
You did your homework.
Will you ever live that down, you think?
not yet.
And then you taught abroad for many years, and you have an MFA from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington.
Right.
So what brought you back to New Orleans? Why have you settled here?
Well, I got the contract for A Letter to My Daughter with Random House in 2008, and I was just about to go back overseas to teach in Tokyo. And when the book was coming out in 2010, I wanted to be back in the United States for the publication of the book, and so I moved back here. I didn't know how long I would be back in New Orleans, but I think I've kind of settled here now.
Well, you have this great story about how you got the idea for A Letter to My Daughter.
Yes. So that came about when I was working in India maybe 6 years ago or so. And I had just finished a two-year contract there. And I went on a holiday in Rajasthan, which is in northern India, where the Taj Mahal and all those places are. And so I went on a camel safari in the desert. And we pitched tents one night, and I went to sleep, and I dreamed that whole novel. And I woke up in the morning, and I made notes, and that became my first published novel, Letter to My Daughter.
What a gift.
It was very lucky. Yes.
So did you have that kind of experience with The Night of the Comet?
No, unfortunately I didn't. No, this book was a lot of work. When I went and met my editor in New York at Random House for Letter to My Daughter, I wanted to bring some other ideas to them for my second book. And I had been tossing around this idea about Comet Kohoutek, you know. And so I said, well, I've got this idea for a book about this comet in this small town. And they said, yeah, that sounds fine. Yeah, you get to work on that. Letter to My Daughter came out 2010. This next book was under contract for 2011. And it turned out to be very difficult to write because I didn't have any dream or inspiration going into it, you know. And as my second novel, I felt like my whole career was hanging on every word that I wrote.
Oh, that's, you know, hard.
It was really hard to write, yeah.
Oh, now I know that you don't like to refer to your books as coming-of-age novels. You don't really think of them in that way. But you do capture the voices of really interesting young people and their parents at moments of great transition. What is it that draws you to that period in a person's life for your characters?
I think you just said it. I think it's a time of great change in people. And so I think it's a very dramatic time in a person's life. So I think it's a natural time to look at for a good story.
Are you channeling your inner teenager?
Maybe. I'd like to think of them more as family stories, though, instead of young adult stories, you know?
So describe the family in The Night of the Comet. They're a very interesting Louisiana family.
Right. So the story takes place in a small town in South Louisiana that I've called Terrebonne, in Terrebonne Parish. But, you know, there's no real Terrebonne. But it's kind of modeled after maybe Thibodeau or Houma, that area. And the father, his name is Alan Broussard, and he's this frustrated high school science teacher, teaches at a very small high school. And he always had bigger dreams because he was always very scientific-minded, and he wanted to study astronomy and so on. But he ended up getting married relatively early. His wife, Lydia, also had, I think, dreams bigger than the town. She grew up in this small town, but she always wanted to get out of the town. But very quickly, they had two children, and they kind of were stuck in the town. And when the comet arrives in 1973, it kind of ignites all these dreams and kind of long-suppressed desires in the family.
It's a catalyst.
It's a catalyst, yes.
And then there are all these telescopes floating around, too, aren't there?
The telescopes, right. And so the father gives his son a telescope for his 14th birthday. And the son, the kid, is the narrator of the story. Or rather, he's looking back at that time, right? And so the telescope also provides a kind of a bridge for the son. He's spying on the new neighbor's daughter with the telescope.
He's doing what any teenager with a telescope would do, don't you?
Of course, yeah.
Oh, but I love that. It just cracked me up the whole moment. So I'm curious to know, do you draw on that acting experience when you write? Don't you find it very helpful?
Yes. You know, I think it is helpful because when you study acting, you do character biographies, you know? And a good actor, at least, you should know everything there is to know about your character, like what you had for breakfast that morning and what your favorite color is and so on. And so I think the same thing when I'm coming up with a character that I'm writing about.
You've packed a lot into this book about this time period because the Comet Kohoutek was sort of a signal event that meant a lot in American life. And you've also packed this small town with all the changes that were going on in American life as well at that time. So what was it like for you to put yourself in the 70s mindset?
You know, I enjoyed doing the research for that. I went back and read a lot of old newspapers and magazines from that time period. And the way I see it is that I thought of it as I was researching it as kind of the adolescence of America, like as this transition period between the kind of childhood excitement and expectations of like the space race,
yep,
right? And in the 1950s all the way up to the Apollo missions and all of that. But then the 70s, I see it as kind of a transition period with the Vietnam War. And then I would say that that period kind of ended with the Challenger disaster that came a decade or so later.
Right. One of the things that I really love about the way you write about Louisiana is that you don't ever draw on any kind of stereotype or wild eccentricity. These are really lovely, recognizable American people. And it's like, we're just like everybody else, which is kind of nice, you know? And just right. How much of that comes out of your own experience? I mean, you said you like to have your characters in a place that's like a bus ride to Baton Rouge.
All right.
You know, which I kind of enjoy. And I wonder, is that your experience filtering through to us?
Well, I think more than that, it's trying to overcome the cliches and stereotypes of Louisiana, because even in setting this story, my previous story in Louisiana, I was a little worried about that because, you know, it's like trying to set something in New Orleans. The city itself is such a character that it can overwhelm the story, and the story becomes about that. And I think you really caught something that I was trying to do, and that is that the small town in Louisiana kind of, for me in these stories, is meant to be representative of small town anywhere.
And it is.
With a bit of the bayou and the feeling around it.
Well, it is fun. I mean, it's a fun, interesting little town to visit, I think. So I thought I would ask you if you would read a little bit for us. Read one of the scenes that sets the character of the father.
Sure. This is chapter 3. My father, the teacher. Sometimes I got the feeling that he hated it. He never said so, but by the end of the week, he'd come home from school looking tired and defeated, the dark crescents below his eyes visible even through the thick lenses of his glasses. He might have been a boxer stumbling out of the ring after losing another round to his students, those bored, gum-smacking teenagers who showed so little love for Earth and space science. Looking up from marking tests at the dinner table on Sunday evening, his hair sticking out on one side of his head, he would say how he could have gone on to graduate school, how, if only he'd stuck with it, he might have had a career in research by now. He talked fondly of his college years at LSU in Baton Rouge, working all night in the Nicholson Hall lab to meet a deadline, swapping ideas with the older students at the coffee machine, the smell of acetone wafting in the corridors. How he had loved it, he said, the pure, heady joy of intellectual pursuit. His old astronomy professor, Dr. Brewer, always said that he showed great promise, told him he had the mind of a scientist, an ability to get inside a problem and visualize a solution. Not everybody had that, Brewer said. It was the kind of talent they looked for in their graduate students. But instead, my father would say, gesturing wearily at the papers spread on the table, the red scrawl of his pen bleeding all over them. He didn't have to say it. The gesture said everything. It was shorthand for all the complaints we'd heard him muttering for years. He had sold himself short. He deserved better than this. If only he hadn't gotten married so young. If only they hadn't had two children and a house and a car that needed to be paid for. Then he wouldn't be sitting here at this table correcting these papers for kids who didn't give a damn, teaching at a poor public school with a broken-down lab and an indifferent principal. Instead, he'd be working at NASA, or Raytheon, or the Palomar Observatory, where the real scientists went, and where people cared about your work. Because he still had it, he said, that feeling for science. That wasn't something that went away. It was like a fire that burned inside you, a passion to know more. Our mad scientist, my mother would joke. He wouldn't laugh. He'd glare at her as though the blame were all hers. Then he'd pick up his pen and go back to correcting papers, his frustration settling like a black cloud around his shoulders. No one appreciated him. No one cared. No one knew the talent and ambition simmering inside him. If only, if only, if only.
Oh, I love that. There are lots of stories of ambition in this book, lots of great hopes, lots of love stories, really interesting families. It's one of our great summer reads, I think. So thank you, George.
Thank you.
You can meet George Bishop when he signs The Night of the Comet, August 4th at 2:30 at the Cabildo with Fartner House Books, August 5th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop, and August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Danny Heitman is a columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate newspaper and the author of A Summer of Birds, John James Audubon at Oakley House. He recently wrote an essay for the Christian Science Monitor about inheriting books, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Danny's joining us from WRKF in Baton Rouge. Hi, Danny.
Hello, Susan. It's good to be with you today.
Well, welcome to The Reading Life, and you are a great reader. I think most newspaper columnists have to be, don't you?
I think that all journalism is grounded in curiosity, and that's really how we feed our curiosity, by reading, right? And so I do think that it's important, if you're going to be a writer, to also be an avid reader.
Amen to that. Now, your essay for the Christian Science Monitor was inspired by inheriting your Aunt Eunice's book collection. So what can you tell me about her? She was 94 and...
My Aunt Eunice was a phenomenal lady. I often think of her as the Johnny Appleseed of librarians. After World War II, she went into North Louisiana, where there were many communities that had no library service at all. And she went into Catahoula, Caldwell, and Franklin parishes and really helped build those library systems from scratch. And she had a great love of adventure. And for her, the love of adventure and the love of reading were really intertwined throughout her life. And so she was a great role model for me as a reader. And she was also a great writer. She was a great writer of letters, which is kind of a lost art. And so whenever she passed away, that was, of course, a great loss, even though she had a long and fruitful life. And in inheriting some of her books, I really felt that I was inheriting a special part of her. And so my essay is really about how our private libraries define who we are and about how those private libraries become a really important legacy for us after we're gone.
So your family gathered to divide her books, and you took books of English poetry, Plutarch, and books about Andrew Wyeth and his work. What did they tell you about Eunice?
Well, it was interesting to me to discover, even though Andrew Wyeth pictures were on my Aunt Eunice's walls all those years, It was interesting for me to discover that she was such an enthusiast of Andrew Wyeth. You know, it's interesting. We tend to overlook things that are right under our noses when we have long relationships with relatives. And we would talk about a great many things when I would visit my Aunt Eunice. But she never talked about Andrew Wyeth. And after she passed away, I discovered all of these Andrew Wyeth coffee table books in her collection. And her stepdaughter had mentioned to me that my Aunt Eunice had had an abiding interest in Wyeth. There were also a great many books about dogs. My Aunt Eunice was a great dog lover. And her poetry books really reminded me that my Aunt Eunice took a great pleasure in the musicality of language. She was a great storyteller. She enjoyed words for their own sake. She was a great champion at Scrabble, played it until shortly before her death. She loved the lyricality of words, and so I wasn't surprised to find that there were great poets on her shelf, and I've really enjoyed connecting with that part of her since she passed away.
Now, you said that the experience of going through her books made you think about your own, and you're looking at books differently as you try and decide what to keep and what to pass along. So what are some of the books you did keep?
I have loved Curious George since I was a child. And it was the first book that I can remember reading. My older sister, Judy, God bless her, she taught me how to read by reading Curious George to me. And sometimes I think that I had children just to have an excuse to have Curious George on my shelf. And now my children are not interested in reading Curious George anymore. My youngest child is 12. And I continue to keep Curious George on my shelf for grandchildren that haven't been born yet. I have a treasured volume of Robinson Crusoe that I read just about every summer since I was 12 myself. And I keep that on the shelf with some hopes that my son will love that book as much as I will. And I've kept all of my Willa Cather novels, you know, Death Comes for the Archbishop and my Ansonia. And I don't think I'm ever going to read Willa Cather again. I may, but I realize as I get older, I'm almost 50, I realize that time is a finite thing. But I keep them anyway, and I think I keep those books because I'm looking toward other generations, and I'm hopeful that my children and grandchildren and perhaps my great-grandchildren will also enjoy these books after I'm gone. So
I know what you mean. I have a whole shelf full of Curious George. I have Curious
George. He was
wonderful. I know, the man in the yellow hat. I have Curious George bookends, all kinds of things.
The thing I love about Curious George is that if you were to try to write that book today, it probably wouldn't get published. He does consistently bad things, and yet he really doesn't face any real consequences for what he does. He gets into the man with the yellow hat's cigars, I think, or his pipe, and he smokes tobacco. He does these politically incorrect things, but I think that he is at heart a rebel, and he's also someone who questions authority, often in good ways. And I think those are good things to teach a kid.
Absolutely. Now, I want you to fess up. What are some of the books you've gotten rid of?
You know, the other day, I decided, Danny, you're 49 years old, and you are not ever going to learn Japanese. Let's face it, it's not going to happen. So I got rid of my English-Japanese, Japanese-English book. I am toying, and I haven't done it yet, but I'm toying with getting rid of the Proust because I have tried Remembrance of Things Past, I think, 6 times now. And I might just have to confess that I'm a Philistine and that I cannot get on Proust's wavelength. I was reading a marvelous essay from the 60s just last week, and I cannot remember the author's name, but he said he finally read Proust whenever his wife packed it for him before he went on a naval mission in World War II. And he was out in the middle of the Atlantic, and they were actually under extended siege from the Germans. And he had nothing else to read, and so he read Remembrance of Things Past really to escape. I think I would probably have to be subjected to something that difficult and life-wrenching to get on Proust's wavelength. And perhaps the problem's more with me than with him, but that's a book I'm considering giving away.
And one of the things you talked about that I liked so much in the essay was that You know, you don't want to inherit somebody else's Kindle or e-reader, which I think is a great point.
That's true. You know, there's such a tactile pleasure in books. And there's also that great sense of communion with the past and with people who are no longer with you when you can physically engage with their belongings. And whenever I pull Aunt Eunice's poetry from the shelf and I read that same Robert Frost poetry that she was reading shortly before she died, I really feel that she's present with me. And I don't think you're going to get that same experience if you inherit someone's Kindle.
Oh, it just makes you love them all over again when you're touching their books, I think.
It is. It's a very intimate thing. And, you know, Amanda Katz, who is a writer for the Boston Globe, she had a marvelous essay for NPR about this very topic of inheriting books. And she said, "When I think of sorting through the boxes of my grandmother's books, even the ones we couldn't keep or didn't want, and what we found there, I am grateful not to have been handed her Amazon password instead." Gosh, that is so true, and I wish I had written that, but she's really put her finger on the distinction between the physical book and then that sort of ephemeral digital text that floats through the ether whenever we connect with an electronic book. So,
well, let's hang on to our books as long as we can. We've been talking with Danny Heitman, Baton Rouge Advocate columnist and author of A Summer of Birds, John James Audubon at Oakley House. Thanks for being with us, Danny.
Thank you, Susan. I very much enjoyed it.
Me too. Henry James once said, "Summer afternoon, summer afternoon." To me, those have always been the two most beautiful words in the English language. I have to agree with him, even on these steaming New Orleans days. So what do I read on my summer afternoons when I'm not reading professionally? What do I read for fun? Well, cookbooks, for starters. I can read a cookbook as if it were a novel. I'm reading Edward Lee's Smoke and Pickles, recipes and stories from a new Southern kitchen right now, which I love. I can't wait to make his pickled jasmine peaches and summer squash soup with strawberries. I always revisit one old favorite author over the summer, and this year that's Alexander McCall Smith, whose new book, Trains and Lovers, is a sweet quartet, stories that four strangers tell each other on a train ride from Edinburgh to London. Alexander McCall Smith gently captures the joy of falling in love in one man's story. I felt around for a word to describe my feelings and found a whole dictionary of words to describe such things. Entrancement, rapture, bliss. There were others, all of them somewhat breathless and none of them capturing what was happening to me. Does everybody feel that he is the only one to have felt this way? The world was suddenly immensely valuable. Everything seemed to have more significance. Every moment seemed to have a hinterland of possibility. We might go for dinner somewhere. We might just talk. We might lie in one another's arms in her room in that flat. Might watch the clouds again through the skylight. Even London itself, that great struggling city, with its washed-out secondhand air, was somehow rendered brilliant and exciting. That's the curious thing about love, isn't it? It makes very ordinary things seem special. It makes them seem so much more valuable than they really are. Something inspirational is always in my summer reading mix. This year, it's My Bright Abyss, Meditation of a Modern Believer by Christian Wiman, a poet who recounts his spiritual struggle in the face of living with cancer. This has been a summer of remembering my husband, who died 10 years ago after his own struggle, and this book has been brightly consoling to me in the way the best spiritual memoirs are. Here's what Wiman says. "Sorrow is so woven through us, so much a part of our souls, or at least any understandings of our souls, that we are able to attain, that every experience is dyed with its color. This is why, even in moments of joy, part of that joy is the seams of ore that are our sorrow. They burn darkly and beautifully in the midst of joy, and they make joy the complete experience that it is. But still, they burn. This book has made me wiser, and I am grateful. Of course, what is summer reading without laughter? And for that, I turn to Carl Hiaasen, the one, the only. Sex, violence, Florida. Must we say more? Any book that begins with a human arm being caught by a deep-sea fisherman has me hooked from page one. And of course, there's the requisite message about what we're doing to the environment. There are greedy house flippers, fascinating and beautiful coroners, corrupt cops, and yes, even a voodoo queen. And the monkey of the title will live on in Hiaasen mythology forever. Bad Monkey was the perfect summer read. I always look for a little project to order my time, so this summer I'm reading Book Art by Claire Youngs in hope of turning out some of her lovely creations, paper birds and artichokes, pop-up books. Not that I approach a book lightly when I'm holding a pair of scissors. And then there are the classics. I know one reader who devotes herself to a different author every summer. I'm determined to read Don Quixote for the one-time, one-book pop-up book club observing the Katrina anniversary. And maybe get a head start on David Copperfield for the Dickens Fellowship this fall. The books stretch on forever, don't they? And in summer, just for a little while, there seems to be time to read them. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sally Newhart discusses and signs her book, The Original Tuxedo Jazz Band, Tuesday, July 30th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. The search for Waldo comes to an end with Waldo parties Wednesday, July 31st at 5 p.m. at Octavia Books and Wednesday, July 31st at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Lola's Eric Eli signs Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans, Thursday, August 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. Chuck Hustmeyer signs The Axeman of New Orleans, Saturday, August 3rd at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, George Bishop, appears Sunday, August 4th at 2:30 at the Cabildo, along with Rick Barton, author of A House Divided, and Lola's Eric Eli, author of Tremé. That's sponsored by Faulkner House Books. George Bishop also signs Night of the Comet Monday, August 5th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop and Tuesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses In the Sanctuary of Outcasts by Neil White, Tuesday, August 6th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. The Fiat Lux Book Club discusses The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, Wednesday, August 7th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. This new group discusses the influence of the Catholic faith on writers from Graham Greene to Walker Percy. Some news for fans of Ladder Library. That branch will temporarily be closed for renovation. That began July 28th, and that will last about 90 days. During the temporary closure, library materials put on hold will be transferred to Nix. The Friends of the Library book sale will continue to operate. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.